Representative Khanna, I want to say, like, I think objectively, a lot of people who have been deeply concerned about the apartheid state of Israel, the genocide in Gaza, find it refreshing to hear a member of Congress speak in this way, and the fact that you also have used this opportunity to try to highlight specific cases of Palestinians. I want to ask you, though, what you think the consequences for Israel should be, not just of these actions, but also for the mass murder of a documented roughly 80,000 people. It's probably much higher than that in Gaza, a significant portion of whom are children. I've heard you talk about sanctioning individuals. I've heard the framing that you and Bernie Sanders offer about offensive weapons or weapons that kill civilians, but I've also heard your defense of Iron Dome. And I want to push you on this because I think a lot of the critique of you from pro-Palestine people and from Palestinians is that the position you're advocating basically amounts to, we need to make sure that the sniper is protected so that he can continue sniping.
Well, if we look, I appreciate the question, and I will answer it specifically. But if you look at all the things I've called for, I've said zero aid to Israel and supporting the Massey Amendment that does that. That's going to be a big vote coming up this week. I've said no military sales to Israel that are used to kill civilians. I've said no military integration and led the fight to repeal Section 224 and 219, which is Netanyahu's end run, where they would just co-produce the military. I said we should call it apartheid and recognize the genocide. So these are, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, it's like going from 1 to 7 or 8. And the debate is, okay, 9 or 10, do I, an arms embargo completely, which I have not supported, would say Israel can't even get or produce from anyone defensive the Iron Dome. And I guess my view is, you know, anyone should be able to protect civilian life, but that's not America supporting it. I do think, though, that there is something that the next administration could do within the first 100 days, instead of just saying, okay, we're going to talk abstractly about this long peace process. Demand the arrest of Yanan Levy and extremist settlers within 100 days. Demand the destruction of every outpost within 100 days. Demand the destruction of illegal settlements within 100 days. Demand justice for Palestinians and Palestinian people so that they stop getting terrorized within 100 days. That doesn't have to be some dialogue. That needs to be a directive from the American administration saying Israel must do this. And we need to be taking steps as we get towards a broader peace in that direction. I think that's one of the things that came out of this trip, the immediacy of the suffering of Palestinians.
I still don't think this is answering the question. I mean, tell me where I'm wrong here. What you're advocating for, we are talking about not just Netanyahu. Sanders always says Netanyahu and his extremist right-wing government. But if you look at public opinion polling, there is widespread support for open genocidal policies. In fact, Netanyahu is often criticized by his political opponents for not having finished the job in Gaza or in Lebanon or elsewhere. And I want to know why it is that you are stopping on this, because so much of what you're saying, it's one of the clearest recognitions of the issue that you could hear from an American politician. And yet you still are saying, but the sniper needs to have protection.
It's not the sniper. It's saying that that we're not, just so we have, there's no ambiguity on my position, which is also the position of Sanders or AOC or others, as I understand it. It is that we have zero military aid to Israel, that we have no military sales that are used to kill, military weapons that are used to be killing civilians. So that's the drop.
I would argue Iron Dome is used to kill. I would argue Iron Dome is used to kill civilians because it allows the Israelis to have this American backing to operate with impunity by openly saying that I support this military technology for Israel. What you're saying is that when Israel attacks other countries who have a right to fight back, that my position is that that sniper, I wish he wasn't doing the sniping, but that sniper has a right to have the United States defending their sniping.
But I don't think that that's the case. If we're stopping all military aid and we're stopping giving them the weapons to kill others, and we're stopping protecting them at the UN, and we're demanding the actions in terms of justice, I don't think that that their policies, whether it's Netanyahu or another Israeli government.
Would you say this about apartheid South Africa? I've heard you talk
about it. Well, because I think, give me another example
where you say it's okay to continue any level of support for an openly genocidal society that has mass murdered 80,000 people, more than 300 media workers, has invaded Lebanon, has bombed Iran, and you're saying, oh, but we need to protect civilians. This isn't about protecting civilians. The greatest threat to their civilians is their policy. And so I don't understand why you have even one qualified shred of support for a sniper mass murderer masquerading as the only democracy in the Middle East.
Well, but I'm not saying that the United States should be supporting the funding for Iron Dome, just so we're clear. I'm saying that we shouldn't be restricting Israel from being able to get the Iron Dome or be able to develop the Iron Dome technology.
Well, I stop there. Everything else you're saying makes so much sense. Why do you stop there? It feels to me like you're trying to have it both ways on this issue. So you can say, well, I actually support, defending the Israeli civilians. You're not defending Israeli civilians with that policy. You're defending the sniper's ability to keep killing because it won't face the ultimate accountability, which is a total embargo on all support for an apartheid state.
Yeah, I don't think you have to put at risk. There are, you would agree, there are innocent civilians in Israel, right? Including 20% being Arab Israelis. I mean, I just don't think that you have to put their lives at risk to achieve the ends of stopping the apartheid, stopping the occupation.
Israel puts their lives at risk by waging genocidal wars with the support of a significant portion of its population, and by enabling them by saying, well, the sniper still needs to have his cover, or well, you know, I stop at this thing. What you're saying is that the accountability then doesn't lie on American policy toward Israel. It's sort of something abstract. Well, Israeli civilians could die. Israeli civilians are dying in these attacks because of the apartheid. You know, do Palestinians have a right to kill Israeli soldiers, Congressman? On October 7th, when they attacked the military bases in the Gaza envelope, did the Qassam brigades in Sarai al-Quds have a right to kill Israeli soldiers? Yes or no? Did Palestinians have a right to attack Israeli military bases in the Gaza envelope? Yes or no?
I mean, I think October 7th attack was a terrorist attack, so I don't
justify.
Was
it a terrorist attack when the first targets that were hit on the morning of October 7th were multiple military bases? Did Palestinian forces have a right to attack those military bases?
I am not for violence again in any way. I mean, I am for making sure that we end the occupation.
Do they have a right to do it, Congressman? Do they have a right to attack Israeli soldiers?
No, I'm not going to say that Hamas had a right to attack Israeli soldiers or kill Israelis. Like I don't think that advances peace or advances Palestinian statehood.
Does Israel have a right to drop a single bomb in Gaza in response to October 7th?
I believe Israel had the right to get people who killed the civilians, but not in the way they went about it, which I've said is genocide.
But the Palestinians don't have a right to attack the very military bases that are running the killing operations on October 6, 2023 or October 5th, 2023. It's a double standard. You're saying there are ways that Israel should be able to kill Palestinians, but there is never a condition under which Palestinians can attack armed, uniformed soldiers of a force that is still considered an occupying force under international law. I don't make it make sense to me how those.
I come from a tradition of King and Gandhi. My father, grandfather was in jail.
I'm aware of your family history. Do you think King would say, "Well, they can attack the Viet Cong, but I don't want them to kill"?
I don't know what Gandhi would say. I don't think my grandfather would say that the Palestinians should have armed resistance to Israeli occupation. I think they would argue for a much more nonviolent approach. But America, I think, in ending aid, in ending military sales, in not being a defender of Israel in the UN, just vetoing resolutions against Israel, would make tremendous progress. I mean, you know, maybe I'm, I, we're on a scale of 1 to 10, and I, you think you're at a 10, and I'm saying, let's go to a 6, 7, 8. I don't know where that would be. And right now America's at a 1.
No, we're at a 10 because we're at a 10 because of a genocide that was enabled, supported, armed, and funded by the United States. And I am baffled as to how you can say that Israel had a right to drop a single bomb on Gaza in response to October 7th, but Palestinians, according to you, have no right whatsoever to ever kill an Israeli occupation.
Palestinians have right to justice, which is in the case of
Do they have a right to armed resistance against Israeli occupation soldiers in uniform? Do they ever have a right to kill an Israeli soldier?
I think if it's a self-defense, if they feel like there's an illegal attack on them by a violent settler or by an Israeli soldier, and that's illegal. In a school or on a civilian, and then of course they should have justice.
But the entire thing is illegal, Representative Khanna. The entire occupation of Gaza, the managing their diet, the mowing the lawn, the constant killing of them. The perspective of many Palestinians is that they're being collectively punished and they're fighting for their very existence, and that the bases that surround Gaza were the primary murderers on a military level of the population of Gaza. So what I'm understanding, whether it's Hamas and Islamic Jihad or it's independent Palestinians, how is it that you can stand here and in any way justify the Israelis dropping bombs on Gaza, but never find a way in which it's justifiable for Palestinians to kill an armed soldier of a force that is under international law an occupation force? I don't understand it.
Well,
I ask you to reconsider this position.
Well, I will look at it, but I don't think that the solution in that area is to encourage
But you're afraid of being called pro-Hamas. That's what this boils down to. Because I bet if we were talking off the record privately, and I said this to you, you would acknowledge that people around the world have a right to resistance by all means necessary.
I've always been for peaceful resistance. You know,
how is peaceful resistance saying the Israelis? You know,
like it's under segregation. I wouldn't have said that go kill people who are engaged in segregation against you. I mean, I'm much more Dr. King than Malcolm X.
Are you much more slave rebellions were justified against people that were raping, hanging, murdering Africans who had been kidnapped? I mean, I'm sorry. I spend most of my day and night talking with Palestinians, working with Palestinians. My colleague Hossam Shabbat was assassinated
by the Israelis. Most of the Palestinians I met, and maybe a few days, are not talking about the kind of armed resistance that you are. They just want to live their lives in dignity and peace and not have the Israeli settlers oppress them.
But you're a member of the United States Congress who is justifying, albeit you've been very critical of Israel's war against Gaza, but you seem to be drawing a line that says that there are some cases in which Israel is justified to attack Palestinians, but only those responsible for October 7th. But you can't find a shred of justification for any Palestinian to attack the very armed forces operating under a nation state flag that is backed by the United States. And you're saying that there is no condition under which a Palestinian has a right to kill soldiers who are posted at military bases enforcing by murder and forced starvation and deprivation an illegal occupation of Gaza. That's what doesn't make sense to me. I don't see how you reconcile those two positions.
Because I think that armed resistance is only going to be ineffective given the power differentials. It's similar to what Gandhi thought in terms of how he took on the British Empire, and that having a moral force of civil resistance and appealing to the world's conscience is going to be much better chance of getting dignity and peace.
2019, the Palestinians organized the Great March of Return, which was a mass nonviolent mobilization at the gates of the concentration camp walls and fence in Gaza. And you know what Israeli soldiers did, Representative Khanna? They had a competition to who could shoot the most kneecaps of Palestinians.
Well, I think that was backed
by Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas. So there's a track record and there's a context. You're talking about a tactical issues. The Palestinians have tried that. The Palestinians did.
I think opinion is shifting now in America, where those kind of approaches would get a better reception in the United States. Masa, what do you think?
We talked a bit about this because I remember that you asked something along the lines of if Hamas was you know, the governing, if there was a state and Hamas was, you know, the governing body, would we be okay with that? And I responded and said, Hamas has been very, very vocal. It's been from the beginning, Hamas would not exist if there wasn't an occupation. The second the occupation ceases to exist is the second that the need to resist ceases to exist, right? So it's, I see what you're saying, but I agree with Jeremy in the sense that there is a, there's a double standard to what you are saying. And we have seen, you've seen yourself now that you've been to the West Bank. A lot of these parents that are talking about their kids being murdered can't even go to where their son was murdered without a bulletproof vest on. It is a violent place. Whether or not we want to, we could talk about peace, but it's, the violence is there. And the only way a lot of times is to defend yourself. It's with violence, which is something that is stripped of the Palestinian citizen. There is, I could be in my house and I could have 50 settlers. I talked to an American citizen in Dearborn, 50 settlers came to her house and the Israeli police said, why didn't you defend yourself? And she said, I would be the one that gets shot if I defended myself. So there are a lot of cases where, as much as we want to be, you know, romantic about the situation, we have the Second Amendment here in the States where, you know, a lot of people would say this is the safest place in the world. Sometimes their only way to defend yourself is with, you know, armed resistance. So I don't know. We talked about this, and I do appreciate that you did. You were listening to people because we did. You had these conversations on the ground, but I do still think that there's some room there to understand that this isn't just armed resistance doesn't exist just because, you know, these are violent people. It's the final. We've tried the UN. We've tried the Oslo Accords. We've tried everything. In the end, this is what needs to happen, you know.
Yeah, I just think the question is whether shifted in American foreign policy can open the doors towards ending the occupation and pursuing justice. But you know, I'll leave my position there.
One way I think about it is if you're not going to acknowledge the right of, you know, armed resistance, the playing field has to be leveled somehow. Like if we're not talking about an arms embargo, you have a state that is relentlessly violent toward a captive population. What would it take? And, you know, Congress is about to fuse the Israeli and American military. And so,
It would take stripping that provision, stopping the military sales, stopping the aid, making sure that there were trials at the ICJ to hold people accountable for the war crimes, for the genocide, and making sure that we weren't protecting Israel's apartheid or genocide in international bodies and working with other countries to push for justice in the region. I guess my view is that would make significant progress.
And while you were there, just real quickly, Rahm Emanuel went to Tel Aviv at the same time that you were there. He had an interesting moment, I thought, where he said the Israeli banking system needed to be sanctioned and any Israeli corporation needed to be sanctioned if it was at all operating in occupied territory. And his questioner pushed back and said, well, that's the entire Israeli economy. You would be sanctioning the entire banking system and basically every company in Israel. And Rahm Emanuel said, yes, we need to sanction. The S part of BDS has always been the one with the sharpest teeth. Would you support a full sanctioning of the Israeli banking system if there are banks that are operating?
And government officials and, you know,
then at that point, then they effectively can barely buy anything, let alone, you know, they wouldn't be able to buy Iron Dome components if they'd made it indigenously. I suppose domestically they could do it, but
I haven't read the details of Emmanuel's speech, but I mean, is he calling for broad-based sanctions on all the financial institutions, or sanctions on the financial institutions who lend to the settlements?
Well, that's all of them, or have any business whatsoever in illegal.
My guess is what you would then see is the Israeli banks cutting off the funding and the subsidies for the settlements, which is which would be significant.
Which
way the settlements would collapse, you're saying?
They would have to. I mean, I don't know how you do it without financing.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting. Anything else?
A good conversation always with Jeremy. He's very, very passionate. I would just hope that people see the Palestinian stories that we heard, the apartheid-like conditions, and the commitment to bring justice and reform. And I'm not where Jeremy is, but I'm certainly a clear outlier with a few other people on the issue and trying to bring real justice.
All right,
I appreciate very much the engagement. I know that's one thing that you're very famous for across the board, that you're willing to argue.
Well, you know, I am a student of Lincoln, not as great, of course, but there were a lot of abolitionists. But the art of American politics, in my view, is to do what is moral, but also possible. And I'm not saying I have the right judgment, but it's not. It's not easy to build that kind of a consensus.
Well, we certainly appreciate the engagement, Representative Rokana.
Appreciate it. Good seeing you. Right. Take care.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Before we bring in Abdullah Al-Aryan, I want to actually underline the point that he just alluded to that may escape some kind of non-Lincoln heads. So Lincoln was throughout his life anti-slavery, but he was never an abolitionist. And the difference during that period was that the abolitionists were seen to be the crazy people. Like they were the ones, they were the radicals. They were like outside of kind of respectable politics. You could be anti-slavery without being abolitionist. And it's very strange to, I think from our perspective now, to understand these political distinctions. Okay. But Lincoln was friends and allies with a lot of abolitionists. And so when he ran, the abolitionists very quietly kind of told all of the rest of the abolitionists, he's not going to say the things we want him to say, but he's actually with us. And that was a message that resonated actually with the South. And the South believed it. And that's why the South seceded on his election. Like, he didn't push them out. The South led when he was elected. So I think what Rokana was saying right there is that Jeremy is the crazy abolitionist. He's willing to say publicly what I actually believe. Because as he said, it's the art of building these coalitions. Like that, what Lincoln was doing was putting together a coalition that included the abolitionists towards the end of ending slavery. But he wasn't willing to go out and say it. That's what I read into that. I might be reading too much into it. And then we'll move to Abdullah. But what did you guys, I'm curious for both of your take on his responses there.
Well, in general, I mean, he's no longer here, so I don't want to continue litigating this issue. But, I do credit Rokana with being willing to engage. You know, there have been a handful of interviews I've seen, particularly when he's gone on with people who are on the left side of the spectrum. I mean, of course, you know, I was just watching clips of him on Fox News, and I think it's important to point out that much of the media narrative about this from the right has been calling him a liar, questioning his patriotism, et cetera. We also know that many of our colleagues in the broader independent media landscape have interviewed him, and he's talked about this. So I feel it's something that I think is not interrogated enough in our political life since the onset of this genocide in particular, but this is also the story of Palestine for a very long time, is that you have political figures from AOC to Bernie Sanders who, and Sanders is a long track record, who try to project a certain image of being in solidarity with the Palestinian people. But you always hit a point where they carve out their own version of a Palestine exception. And so, you know, I feel like when we have, you know, so much of what you're doing, Dropsite, is reporting, you know, from Gaza, from the occupied West Bank. We've had colleagues murdered. We're immersed in this because we believe in it. And, you know, and so it's not like I'm just throwing gotcha questions at him. What I'm asking him is based on the on actual relationships with Palestinians, knowing Palestinians who've been murdered, having Palestinian friends who've had 200 plus members of their family murdered in Gaza, looking at public opinion polling on the question of armed resistance in Palestine. You can't cherry pick and say, well, the people that I talked to as an American congressman over the course of an hour one day or a dinner one night, this is representative of the Palestinian people. I don't think many Palestinians are going to run up to Rouhani and have the first thing that they say be, we have a right to armed resistance. He's a member of Congress visiting an area of the occupied West Bank, where, as Mesa has pointed out, there are a lot of people who also hold American passports there. And so, you know, Rouhani was doing his public service in a way that makes sense. But you can't pretend to speak in general for the Palestinian people as a whole based on some conversations you had over the course of a few days. And so all of which is to say that, you know, Rouhani should be given credit for the work that he's done on this. It's unusual to have an American political figure do what he's done. But that doesn't mean that our job as journalists is just to fluff him up. Yep. And, you know, and so I this is something that I think really needs to be put in front of people like Bernie Sanders or Rouhani, where we say, yeah, there's a lot of things that I agree with. But on this issue, I mean, I'm glad that we had this interaction, because it's clarifying to hear him say that there isn't a justification for Palestinians even to kill Israeli occupation soldiers, but there is a justification to drop bombs on Gaza. And to me, it's in the public service to have that discourse with an elected member of Congress who actually is pretty good on this issue, on most aspects of it. Because many Palestinians, if they were to say what I'm saying, fear they would be arrested, you know, or that their lives would end. You know how many messages I get from Palestinian colleagues of mine who say, you're saying things that would get me arrested. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of that. And part of why I do ask these questions, or I interview the people that I do, or I try to report on the perspectives that I do, and we do this at Dropsite, is because it's our duty to do it.
Right. Somebody has to.
Yeah.
A couple things I want to point out too is that the West Bank, there is a bourgeoisie class, you know, and whenever Roe pointed out that before he took this trip, if he would go on these trips to Israel, they would take him to Ramallah, he would spend some time with Abbas, they would go to a nice restaurant, whatever. The people that he saw this time, or the people that I saw him interact with, again, I keep repeating, American citizens, their experience is completely different than the people in refugee camps in Tul Karam or in Jenin or Nur Shams. And those are the conversations where he would have had, where he would have talked about armed resistance, because there are weapons there and they've been killed not only by the Israeli military, but by the PA. And so there's more that he, what Jeremy's saying is correct in the sense that he had a few conversations and I think it enlightened him, but the West Bank shouldn't be seen as just a monolith. There are multiple experiences, which is by design, that the population is very, very fractured and everybody has their own version of the occupation. So, and the other thing is that I think we're past, my dad's generation was the generation of Palestinians are human. That was their argument to the world. It's like, just please see us as human. I think we're past that. And it's, we're not just human, we deserve the same rights as anybody else. We deserve a military. We deserve, you know, free access. We deserve connection to the world. It's not just to see. I think we're past the point of looking at us as just victims. It's now Palestinians are demanding. We're talking face to face now. We're not. It's not just, you know, can you protect me? And so that's. I mean, I really appreciate what we saw here today, because I don't want us to get into the the practice of just applauding for people for looking and for speaking out. Whenever we see countries who have joined like the Hague group that have but have made millions with their relationships with Israel on the side, like we are in that point of the movement, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
You know, Mesa, we have Abdullah Al-Aryan is standing by, but Mesa Mustafa just did some really important reporting from the occupied West Bank, and we'll make sure to re-up that also in the context of this on our social media feeds. And Mesa, thanks so much for being on the ground there and doing such terrific reporting.
Of course. Thank you, guys.